This is Derek Holroyd presenting London Column. London Column, which brings you items specially chosen for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide service of the BBC. This week, we'll visit Henley Regatta, and we'll hear from a famous American visitor to Britain, Cornelia Otis Skinner. But first, we'll go exploring in a little-known section of England, the Norfolk Broads. Many of the American airmen stationed in England during the war were based in East Anglia, and may have had an opportunity of sailing on the Norfolk Broads. This region resembles more the coast of Holland or Denmark than it does the rest of England. And one of our commentators has just returned from a trip on these inland waterways. Here he is, Winford Vaughan Thomas.
The Norfolk Broads are only 100 miles from London. Yet if you get into the right part of them, you can feel as lost and secluded as if you were in one of the wild reed-covered reaches of the Zambezi River itself. Now, geologists will tell you that the Broads are simply a string of shallow lakes and lagoons formed by a sandbank damming up the mouths of three of the Norfolk rivers. The geologist will also add that he's got the depressing information that the Broads are silting up quite rapidly from the geological point of view. But once you go cruising on them, as I did last week, well, you forget all about geology. You just revel in a landscape that must be quite unique in England. Now, holiday-making on the Broads is an art all of its own. You hire a motor cruiser or a yacht from one of the convenient boatyards that are scattered along the rivers, and then you simply disappear for a week, exploring. You float down those slow-running streams whose very names of Bure and Yare and Thurn are as English current in them. Or you might pause on some lonely reach just to throw a line overboard, for the Broads are the greatest coarse fishing waters in England, and in every one of the lovely little riverside pubs, the bar parlours are lined with stuffed pike and roach and bream is quite unnecessary. Why, even I caught a bream up to 2 pounds, and I'm told by the locals that that's absolutely nothing. But if you don't want to fish, well, then there's the charm of sailing. Sailing first down through the Broads below Wroxham. Now, these are cozy, tree-lined lagoons with the rich summer vegetation of England crowding down to the water's edge. And then, buried among the trees, you come across one of the Broadland churches with its round tower and reed-thatched roof. And then on you go to the lower reaches of the river as they approach the sea. Now here, the waters flow through a wide, bare countryside, Dutch in its flatness, but flat for the towers of the windmills and the hundreds of white sails of the yacht, tacking up river and looking almost as if they were sailing over the fields. And then finally, you enter the Broads that are nearest the sea itself, Hickling and Horsey. Now here, you're in another world than England. Your boat is lost among tortuous channels, twisting among the reed beds, and the rare birds of the Broads, the Montague Harrier, that we call the Eagle of Southern England, and the curiously named Bittern, brown and elusive, and that makes the strangest sound of all the British birds, known to the locals as booming, a deep drumming note that echoes over the quiet Broads in the breeding season. All these birds and wild duck and a host of the small singing birds swarm in Hickling Broad. It's one of Britain's great bird sanctuaries. My last memory of my Broadland trip, cruiser, lost among the tall bulrushes and the reeds, and the hot sun playing over the still waters, and the silence broken only by the frail piping of a reed warbler, and then the sudden splash of a great pike leaping. Oh, if only I could get my fishing line to him. And all around, a peace that you only get now on the Norfolk Broads.
Back now to London life, where we're delighted at having another visit from your famous American actress and author, Cornelia Otis Skinner. Miss Skinner is performing nightly at the St. James's Theatre with what seems like unanimous approval and approbation. As you no doubt know, she carries a whole evening of dramatic performance entirely by herself, assuming every sort of role in the most convincing manner and peopling the stage with a host of unseen characters. We were fortunate in having Miss Skinner come to our studio, where our interviewer, John Ellison, wanted to find out just what she called her unique form of dramatic art.
What do you call it, though?
I don't know exactly. In America, they call me a monologist because I give monologues. Mm-hmm. As the Irish fireman at one theater put it, she just talks to herself for 2 hours. Other people get locked up for that. I suppose the best way is to say that I perform in plays in which I play all the parts. That's what I'm going to do here.
Do you ever appear with other actors?
Yes, but sometimes I'm inclined to forget. Well? The first play I was in after doing a solo tour, the leading man came up during rehearsal and said, "Listen, Toot, you've got help now." That was in Lady Windermere's Fan. On the last night, I suspected some skullduggery from him. And when I was supposed to gaze into the miniature of my grandchild and wipe a tear away, I found myself staring at a picture of Boris Karloff in one of his most hideous essays.
How did you become an author as well?
Well, I started writing a letter to a friend, describing how, although I'd ridden in blue jeans in Colorado on a western saddle with a comforting pommel to hold on to in case of difficulty, that wasn't good enough for my husband. He didn't think much of the pride of the western trails. He had me come over to England, and I found myself accoutred in a riding habit for sitting side saddle.
Oh.
I couldn't move on the ground, let alone on a horse. And that was the end of that. I've never been on a horse since. Oh, I forgot. I read the letter through after I'd written it. It's always a fatal thing to do with any letter. And instead of sending it to my friend, I sent it to a magazine. They published it and paid for it. So I went on writing instead of writing.
Well, that's one way of becoming an author.
Then I took to writing these plays. I act in by myself and taking them on tour. Have you ever been on tour?
Oh, yes, I have indeed.
Then you know how I felt when I played 118 performances in 116 towns.
Oh.
Towards the end of the tour, I was getting a bit of fresh air in a park bench, and suddenly I tried to remember which way I went to get back to the hotel. And I tried to remember which hotel it was. Then I asked myself, what city was I in? I got quite panicky. I didn't dare go up to anyone and ask, and then a piece of newspaper blew by. I grabbed it, and I knew I was in Cleveland, Ohio.
Well, we hope Miss Skinner will have no difficulty in remembering she's in London now, and that she'll remember her visit here with pleasure. And now, with the weather continuing to smile on us here, let's pay a visit to another of England's classic sporting events, the Royal Henley Regatta. For it's at Henley-on-Thames that the pick of Britain's rowing crews compete for many trophies, and crews from abroad are welcome too. One of the big events, the race for the Thames Challenge Cup, was won this year by the crew from Princeton University. Let's hear how the scene at Henley appeared to our reporter, Roland Fox.
Here in the cradle of English rowing, where the River Thames flows lazily between the lush, wooded slopes of Buckinghamshire and Berkshire, the internationally famous Henley Royal Regatta has begun once more. I've called it the cradle of our rowing because it was at Henley, where for more than a mile the river runs almost straight and forms a perfect racing course, that the Oxford and Cambridge boat race had its beginnings, and where the Henley Regatta itself was first held 110 years ago with only two events. Now there are 10 events and as many coveted trophies. And there are crews and scholars here from America, Denmark and Holland to vie with the cream of our own clubs and schools. The weather's superb, perhaps a little too warm for those who have to perform Herculean tasks in their eights, fours, pairs or fragile sculling shells. But with not much stream and a light following breeze, conditions are excellent for some really fast times. Already the punts and boats and canoes that traditionally line the booms on either side of the course are well filled with fashionably gowned ladies and their partners in white flannels and straw boaters. And here in the steward's enclosure, the veteran oarsmen provide their own splash of colour with pink caps and white caps and vivid yellow caps, Cambridge blue blazers and Oxford blue scarves, and some of the stewards even wear a mixture of colours that tell of their variegated rowing careers. Then there are the gay awnings of a massive marquees and stands, the bunting and flags bedecking various buildings near the course, and over on the Berkshire side, a wonderful display of roses almost puts to shade the stripes of the deck chairs behind them. Outside the enclosures, there's a helter-skelter and a big wheel and all the fun of a fairground, festival floodlighting of the Henley Bridge and church, and on Saturday night, a firework display. Today, it's a peaceful summer scene with the quiet broken only by the boom of the starter's gun, the band with its special songs for winning crews, and the three cheers which each crew somehow manages to raise for their rivals after each race.
And now we turn for comment to London columnist Alan Melville.
This is Alan Melville speaking. There's been a great deal of sporting activity in the last few London columns, and you may have got the impression that in high summer, London does little else but attend cricket matches, tennis championships, race meetings and regattas on the river. Well, this isn't so.
Several million Londoners go on working as usual through June and July, though they don't hit the headlines like the few thousands who go on strike as usual, for various somewhat obscure reasons. It is a fact, however, that a great many of our most important sporting events are crammed into what used to be called the season. Now, the season, in the spacious and unplanned days of King Edward VII, was a gay and hectic period in which high society, not so high society, and unabashed gatecrashers rushed immaculately garbed from one social or sporting encounter to the next, being photographed incessantly in the process for the glossier weekly papers. The gentlemen wore morning dress and grey top hats to attend race meetings and even to watch the Eton and Harrow cricket match. The ladies kept their most startling ensembles for Ascot and paid far less attention to the GGs than to each other's gigors. Debutants were presented at court, balls were given nightly at which vast numbers of eligible young bachelors were cunningly lured to the conservatory by anxious mothers who had either to get their daughters off their hands that season or retire in shame to the country for the rest of their lives. White ties and tails were as obligatory at the opera as picnic baskets and straw hats at Henley. I've tried to find out precisely when the season began and ended, but not having any friends in high society, this has been difficult. The nearest I got was the view of one sprightly octogenarian who said firmly that in her day, anyone seen in London after the Gold Cup day at Ascot was regarded as a social leper. Where they went to, no one knows, abroad, I suppose, for there was an interval in their activities before they reappeared in Scotland in August, wearing thick tweeds and over-long kilts, to the great amusement of the local inhabitants and the grouse whom they were attempting to shoot. Well, nowadays, mainly because we can no longer afford an aristocracy which, in its turn, can afford to behave that way, we don't have a season. But all the great outdoor events of these summer months are still held, and they're as crowded and as popular as ever. They've become rather more free-for-alls, and a good thing, too. The morning dress is mostly hired at $6 a day, plus deposit, but you'll see far more open-necked sports shirts than grey toppers. London doesn't empty at the end of the season. It never did, but it was fashionable to pretend that it did. In fact, it fills with very welcome visitors from the provinces and from overseas. The theatres stay open throughout the summer, starting earlier than in the old days. You can go in flannels to see the delectable Mrs. Otis Skinner at 7 p.m, where formerly you attended in full evening dress at 8:45 or at 9. People who used to take a yacht to the Riviera now hire a sailing boat on the Norfolk Broads. The fashionable gloss of a London season has gone. But, thank goodness, neither governments can nationalise nor taxation destroy the things that made it and still make it. The sun, the river, the sport, and the colour. Goodbye. And now, across the waters of the Atlantic, we bring you the sound of Bow Bells, the bells of the Church of St. Mary Le Bow. And to their music, this is Derek Holroyd closing London Column. London Column, produced by Stephen Eckard, which came to you in the North American service of the BBC.
London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.